This week, we have something special for you. Five CMOs who are at the very top of the game.
First off, let's hear it for the girls on this day. I don't know what y'all feel, but it feels good sitting here with these women.
Welcome to Builders, a podcast from BetaWorks Studios featuring the amazing people who build things. The makers and the doers, not just the talkers. The people who are helping shape this world and the next world we'll live in. My name is Layla Ueda, and I'll be your guide. Be sure to subscribe to Builders in iTunes or wherever you listen to podcasts. We release new episodes every Tuesday. All these episodes are recorded live at Studios, our New York City clubhouse for builders and anyone else interested in the startup ecosystem. Each week, they feature a new and diverse mix of people drawn from our community. Only at BetaWorks Studios will you find founders and the network around founders authentically chatting about subjects that really matter. If you want to know more about our club, just visit betaworks-studios.com anytime or contact me for a day pass. But listening to these podcasts is a pretty good reflection of life here. One week, we might be talking about how to design for blockchain or build experiences in the age of Instagram. And the following week, we're chatting with technology luminaries like Jaron Lanier on why we should probably all delete our social media accounts. We love looking ahead, but we also like taking stock. This week, we'll go deep on marketing. We have five of the smartest CMOs getting real about modern marketing. You'll hear from Joanna Lord of ClassPass, Pam Eel from the NBA, Emily Culp, former CMO of Keds, Linda Boff from GE, and Christina Carbonell, co-founder of Primary Comp. Usually we play some highlights, but honestly this week it's all highlights, so we're going to just get straight into it. You'll first hear from Rich Greenfield, media analyst at BTIG, who hosted the special roundtable.
So thank you all for coming. This was really John Borthwick's idea. John was like, you should do interesting events here. We've got a whole group of entrepreneurs and makers who would love to hear these stories as well. And so my goal was to bring together the media industry, both digital as well as legacy media, bring together entrepreneurs, bring together investors in public and private. And I think we've kind of accomplished that with a tremendous mix of people here tonight. I'm going to very quickly just introduce who we've got on stage, and then I'm going to get right into Q&A. We'll go for like 40 minutes, and then I'll open it up to the audience. You can ask some questions, and then we can finish with cocktails, and which I'm sure you're more excited about than listening to me. So real quick, we've got Joanna Lord from ClassPass, Pam Eel from the NBA, got Emily Culp, former CMO of Keds, Linda Boff from GE, and Christina Carbonell, who's co-founder of Primary.com, and has spent a long time in marketing. We've got five women who are incredible marketers on stage. I thought maybe as a way to start, you know, I think one of the big questions we get today, got a crowd that probably is certainly younger than a broadcast TV audience. Sorry for any of you that are not younger than a broadcast TV audience. When you think about reaching younger consumers, you know, or reaching groups of consumers, obviously no marketing, there's no one size fits all for marketing. But when you think about reaching younger consumers, what's the most important thing that you're thinking about? Like, what really differentiates reaching a younger consumer versus, you know, your average consumer? How do you even begin that battle? Anyone can start. Pam, you want to start? You've obviously done a great job with the NBA. So
thank you so much.
Start with that.
I will. First off.
I am doing a great job at the NBA.
First off, let's hear it for the girls on this day. It is, like, I don't know what y'all feel, but it feels good sitting here with these women. And now, back to the age thing. I am that generation that's older that still watches TV and that kind of stuff, so be careful what you say. What was your question? No. How do you reach younger audiences? So at the NBA, we know a couple of things. Believe it or not, a lot of people still watch television, particularly if it's news or if it's live sports. So we kind of have a jump on everybody else that's not in one of those two categories. We just had a game in Shanghai Sunday, and we had a game, a second game in China this morning. Sunday, 42 million unique people watched that game in China. This morning, the game was on, by the way, at 8 o'clock in the morning. And those numbers, when they come in tonight, are going to be much bigger than any audience we have in the U.S. for a game. And that's watching CCTV in China. So TV still works, particularly for sports. Let me get that. But what we also know at the NBA is that most of our fans, most of the people who watch our games, who follow our games, are under the age of 35. And those are the folks who have said, I don't even want a television. I'm never going to have a television. I don't have room for a television. I can't buy one. I don't need one. I'm never home. So we are going after all of those platforms where we can reach that under 35-year-old where they are. Now, with a live game, because we have these big broadcast deals with ESPN and Turner in the U.S., that's where you can watch those games. You can't watch those live games. You can't go to Facebook and watch that live game. But you can follow the Twitter stream about that live game, or you can follow the conversation on Facebook, or you can follow the highlights on Instagram, which is what we know young people are doing if they are not sitting at home watching that game. So highlights are hugely important to us. The storylines are very important to us. And more importantly are what the players themselves are doing. So there was this article just this weekend about players who go off the court and go in the locker room and get on Instagram and see who said something about them or who's following them or who's doing what. We don't really like that during halftime, but they can do what they want to do during halftime. But we're going to be where that fan is, and that's our rule about any and everything. So whether it's television or whether it's one of the social media platforms or whether it's our own subscription product, that's where we're going to be.
And having lived through KEDS, what do you think?
Yeah, I think adding to that, to me, where I'm obsessed with the consumer is thinking about their ecosystem. Like, what does their life look like? And there are a few stats to me that are quite sobering. One is there are 8 billion connected devices right now within the U.S. And why I think that's really important is I call it the halo. When you think about your consumer, most likely they have a phone, they might have a tablet, a desktop somewhere, or a TV screen flickering off in the background. For me, one of the most important areas to reach the millennial consumer at KEDS was social media. Again, when you think about the fact that 64% of consumers between the ages of 18 and 29 are on Instagram, that's a very, very powerful tool. So we over-indexed in social media and also in experiences that we would live stream through Facebook globally. So again, it's thinking about that ecosystem, how many devices, where is your consumer spending her time, and making sure that you're there in a relevant way.
You know, my colleague Brandon Ross, who's here as well, he spent a lot of time writing about, we cover a lot of the, like Live Nation and WWE.
Yep.
And one of the things that we really, and he's written quite a bit about, is the millennial is shifting from wanting goods or, you know, wanting to buy things to experiences.
And right.
So how does that play into as you think about creating experiences that millennials can be at?
So as the GE heavy industry manufacturing don't make KEDS person on this
still love you.
I'll take that. You know, for us, it has always been, how do we stay relevant? So we're 130 years old. It's hard to stay relevant. It's even harder to stay relevant when you're not in somebody's pocket or somebody's hand or on somebody's foot.
Mm-hmm.
But we have found that there are people out there that absolutely groove on the technology and science that we absolutely groove on. And for us, that can be jet engines and locomotives and wind turbines, but the DNA around where science is pushing has been something that we've really embraced. So I'm going to get to your experience question. So for us, we have taken these moments of science and mixed a cocktail, so to speak, with pop culture. So for us, what does that look like? So at South by Southwest a couple years ago, we did a barbecue research center. And what we were trying to show was that GE was getting involved in the Internet of Things and big data. So we used data in a big super smoker to tell the story of data, but through barbecue. And we've done similar things where we've tried to take our content, but serve it in ways that people touch and feel. And I just think, I don't know, Rich, to me, all this comes back to what are those poorest moments of engagement? And it can be broadcast or social media or experience, but it's where people are receptive.
And I think to your point, I mean, honestly, one of the, with KEDS, you would think a lot of it would be shoe try on experiences and what have you. For us, where I really pushed the needle actually was around a broader or a higher purpose around female empowerment, which was actually having the brand, because it's been empowering women for 100 years, celebrate whether it's been International Women's Day or Women's Equality Day, and actually having amazing panels such as this, with amazing CEO women-founded companies and then streaming it globally. And that's actually been the experience. So it's not as high touch or touching the product, but it's actually standing for something and then having a consumer pause and really fall in love with that brand and hopefully exploring
the
more.
The ethos of the brand, essentially.
Correct. Yes.
Christina, how do you get people to love your brand?
I think for us, what
you're a startup brand, so
I am, yeah, and we're a kids' clothing brand, 3.5 years old. And I think what we've learned most in these early stages is how important it is to have a point of view and to be authentic about it and to be sort of personal about it. Our point of view within the kids' clothing space was about not chasing trend, and rather being about sort of essential styles for every kid and a rainbow of colors for every kid, where we're not prescribing sort of what's for boys and what's for girls and what kids should wear, but just letting them be themselves. And in the beginning, we were reluctant to really put our point of view out there in a way that might be alienating to people. And what we learned most was that was the real way to build customer passion and to stand for something that people cared about. And to build a brand, that's what you have to do. You have to stand for something. And so as soon as we started to say things like, why can't boys wear pink? That's ridiculous. You know, why do girls' clothes say pretty princess and boys' clothes say mommy's little genius?
And where my daughters go, they do have a pink day where everyone wears pink.
We have nothing against princesses.
Crazy.
Or pink.
How many people are ClassPass members in the room?
All right.
Okay, so how do you build a brand? How do you get people to love you?
It's so much of what's been said, it feels just spot on, right? I think we're fortunate. The majority of our customer base is under 35. I will be asking you guys questions when we break into the some you know, different demos. But I think one of the things that we've thought a lot about
is...
I don't. I was a mess at 35.
We'll get you some green juice.
But I do think we think a lot about what we stand for. We also think a lot about what we don't stand for, you know, in that. And I think, you know, people talk often... these kind of buzzwords that are thrown out, we're transparent, we're authentic, and these are really good words, but what does that mean when you talk about what you don't represent and what you are against? And, you know, we talk a lot about what is that right villain? And for ClassPass, we've actually taken a really big stance on this. We don't do fear-based marketing. We're a fitness brand that refuses to tell you to lose weight. And I think, you know, could we have grown faster 5 years ago if we went all in on talking about how these classes helped you lose weight and hit your body goals? Probably. I don't really care. I think, and we were very, very intentional about that. So this kind of concept of, you know, not just what do we really believe in, but how are we going to be provocative? How are we going to stand out from the noise and start a conversation that's bigger than our company? And how are we going to then help all these people participate in that conversation? So you were talking about experiences. I couldn't agree more. We do a lot of different experiences. Many of them are not fitness classes. We host conversations that are just greater than body goals and fitness, and it's more about health. Work-life balance, you know, how do you invest in yourself? How do you make time for yourself as a busy woman running around in all these different directions? And we're just lucky to be a part of the conversation. We don't necessarily need to direct it.
When you think about ROI, I mean, I assume ROI, every single person, I assume the five of you live and breathe ROI.
Yeah.
Linda, why don't you start us off, because you've got the biggest budget, you know, by far. I'm not spilling any secrets here, but ROI, like, what's
you can
important?
Share it. It's fine.
I guarantee that I do not have the biggest budget on the stage. So
I promise.
Yeah. Don't look at me.
Yeah.
We have another new CEO looking at our costs as of 8 days ago. So I don't know that that's it. So you know, we look at it across the funnel. So for us, upper funnel metrics are important, and I have this conversation a lot with marketers, which is it only counts at the point of conversion or, you know, the last click to buy. I actually think that, as I said before, it's partly remaining relevant, but it's also, you know, intent to purchase for us is huge. We operate in 180 countries. We've got some fierce competitors. So our brand accounts for, you know, I think it's like 35% of purchase price. So we measure upper funnel, but we measure it all the way through. Revenue marketing, are we driving demand? And it's challenging in long cycle businesses. Mm-hmm. You know, when you're going to buy a gas turbine, it's not an impulse purchase. It's
no, but I mean, it's got to be easier for primary.com, right? I mean, or for ClassPass.
Yeah.
I mean,
yeah.
You transact pretty quickly after you run an ad. I assume the goal is to transact.
Yeah, I mean, the irony being, I don't know if it's every single business has like just a hot mess when it comes to attribution, right? And I feel like, candidly, the majority of our acquisitions come from referral. And while, yes, we have these really healthy referral systems and everyone tells everyone and that's really great, the reality is a lot of it's word of mouth. I mean, it's just, it's what I call the brunch effect. Two women are having avocado toast and ClassPass gets shared. And I think like that's a really beautiful moment, but how do you track that? How do you know when which of your touch points influence them at what point? And you know, trying to come up with weighted models that are sequenced across device and you know over 3 days or 3 months is still hard for every business. And
just want to make a note, I do like avocado toast.
Everyone loves
avocado.
Everybody
does. More green juice and avocado toast.
Yeah, so much.
I think one of the interesting things that always comes up, or at least for me in the past few years, is there seems to be this conundrum that you have to pick brand or performance marketing. And everyone's like, which one are you going to pick? Well, if you love your consumers and you actually want to have a long-term business versus managing by quarter or what have you, you need to do both. And that's where you're balancing the qual and the quant. You're looking at short-term decisions and long-term going back to the cycle. But you would never in your wildest dreams, if you're fully fixated only on performance marketing, you would never do a pop-up shop. You never do top of the funnel SEM, and you would never do a press preview. Those are things you could never 100% do attribution around, but you would never have a business after a certain point. So I think it's more the really interesting thread to me is that sort of tension and making sure that you're sharing education with everyone, whether it's outside investors or what have you, that you need both, and it's how you manage accordingly.
I couldn't agree more. Yeah.
I think you also have to think about if you're a global brand, your ROI in this particular country is going to be very different than in another country.
Give us an example.
I talked about China. We're the number one team sport in China. And we have a ton of fans in China. So the awareness of the NBA is not a real issue. The awareness of the NBA is not an issue here, of course. But from an ROI perspective, I still have to think about not making you aware of the NBA, but are you aware that the season starts on October 16th, which is next Tuesday, by the way, y'all. Golden State Warriors, okay, get their rings. But people just say NBA, and then you have to, you think NBA, okay, they're everywhere. Yeah, but I need you to go watch a game, because that's how our broadcasters make money that they have already paid to us. So that sort of awareness. 2.5, 3 weeks ago, I was in India. In India, there's cricket, there's badminton, believe it or not, and there's everything else. And we're number 9th or 10th on the list when it comes to awareness of a sport in a country. But that's a major country that we want to do business in. So we have to go into India with a very different set of metrics than we would go into China or than we would go into Latin America. And I think a mistake that a lot of brands make is, I'm going to do this everywhere I go. I'm going to be this everywhere I am. And that's not the case. You can't do that.
When you think about building that, you know, Emily, you mentioned the split performance marketing and brand marketing.
Right.
We live in a world where, you know, Facebook and Instagram and Snapchat, everything is like this quick hit, right? Like, you know,
right.
It's almost like, you know, getting a shot.
Correct.
How do you build a brand in that culture where we're all literally flicking through, tapping through? I mean, yeah, do I see the ads on Instagram and on Snapchat? But you're, you know, literally as fast as you're tapping very often. Like, how do you actually create brand in a digital mobile world? What are the techniques that any brand can use in this world of clicking?
Yeah, I mean, I think it comes down to two key principles. One is the whole idea around paid, owned, and earned, the Poe cycle of life, if you will. I mean, this is where in social media, you need to have phenomenal own channels. So your Facebook feed, Instagram feed, that's where you have an opportunity to tell your brand story and how you want a consumer to engage with your brand. I think what you're also alluding to is the 6,000 little 6-second ads that flick around or what have you. Unless you are Geico, Verizon, or Bank of America, who seem to have unlimited resources, apology in advance if anyone's from there, I want your budgets. I'll just take 10% of your budget would be fine. Those are the budgets I want because they actually can build the frequency. So you actually remember the ads because you're so exposed to them. The rest of us who don't have that funding, I actually would be more apt to spend the investment in creating content, killer content on your own channels, or for that matter, investing more in the 15 or 30 second TV spots or online spots, but where you can actually tell the whole story. Because it's just too hard to do it otherwise in these super quick hits.
How do you think about telling a story, Christina?
I think what we've learned is that you have to be visually arresting, you do have to be provocative, and you have to have a very clear call to action. They're not new ideas, but I think the combination of those things is really important. We've been extremely successful on Facebook in particular, but we've also spent a lot of time focusing on it.
And give us an example of what you're doing that is successful.
Well, it is those things, and certainly because we have been marketing for a long time now, including at diapers.com and Quidsi, where we marketed in so many different ways. We started primary and thought we were instantly going to market in 25 channels all at once, and instead we did two, because we really had to focus and figure out what we were doing.
And what were those two?
Facebook was one of them, and Google search and figuring out what was going on there was the other, apart from just word of mouth. And for us in Facebook, it was about being as authentically provocative as we could about this point of view that we had within the children's clothing space, and using what we had visually to be as arresting as possible. And you had to look at that ad and say to yourself, people are going to stop, and they're going to talk about it. And if you couldn't say yes to those two things, then you're probably going to be wasting your money.
I mean, Rich, can I just make one comment? You have to have a story to tell, right? I mean, if you don't have that, none of the rest of this works. I mean, all these other elements of being arresting and thumb-stopping and, all the other buzzwords that get thrown around. But if as a brand you don't have that sort of core understanding of your DNA, you never get to do the Colin Kaepernick ad. Right? It wasn't just that somebody, I think, I have no idea, woke up and said, aha, they just knew who they were inside. And that's the heart of it.
So like when you do like the Millie campaign?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, for those of you who don't know, thank you for the little ad. So
I'm promoting everyone.
I know.
I'm doing my own marketing. Yeah, we're going to get more.
It's equal love. It's really good. So
we're selling NBA tickets afterwards. I didn't tell you. So. There's a little stand set up out front.
You'll do pretty
well. Take your money by square.
It's exactly what Emily said before, which is, what do you stand for? So a year and a half or so ago, we launched this effort to balance the equation around having an equal number of women and men in our entry-level programs and in science and tech. And look, we're not the only ones that have had a challenge in this area, but it was a way that we could hopefully be a bit of a catalyst in the conversation, not own it. And so the story we told, which I do think was a great story, even though I'm prejudiced, was the story of a 95-year-old MIT professor, Millie Dresselhaus. And the gist of this was, what if the celebrities of today were scientists? Those are our unseen stars. And we told this very enigmatic story and sort of showed, Millie in cute sweatshirts and sort of a la Kardashian, except she was a scientist and that's why she was famous, and broadcast it on the ceiling of Grand Central, kind of the unseen stars. So that is what I mean. Yep. Like, if you have something to say, there are wonderful ways to figure out how to say it. But I don't think there's a brand up here that doesn't sort of, have a core sense of who we are, and then you craft what that looks like.
I think, to your point, it's about being bold and knowing, like, having a very strong DNA brand positioning, and that's where you can break through.
Because I look at a world where, you think we have Hulu's in the room, I noticed, before Pete Naylor's here. Like, you can pay to not have ads on Hulu, and you have Spotify where you can pay to not have ads, and I can have an ad blocker, and I can have Netflix, and I can spend most of my daily life, if I want to, avoiding ads, which seems to make the five of yours job that much harder to break through when so many people are trying to avoid advertising. And is that an existential threat that you think about, or you just can't even worry about the fact that there's all of this kind of ad-free world that's out there?
I personally, like, you definitely take it, but, like, I don't lose sleep over it because 60% in the Hulu people can correct me, choose still to take the ad-supported model. So that's 12, fair. I think around, 12 million consumers who you can still reach. That's a lot of people. I'm excited to talk to them. And frankly, for the other ones I can't reach, this forces me as a marketer to be smarter, to actually know my consumers better, to actually get to know their behavior and learn those insights and figure out, is it product placement on TV shows? Like, there are other ways to reach consumers that actually might be more authentic and less disruptive. So I actually see it as pushing us to do a better job.
To be less disruptive.
Yeah.
Yeah. I also would add, and I couldn't agree more, I do think that this also forces us to be more responsible with the customers we have. Yeah.
Like, don't waste my time.
Well, and be loyal, like, and invest in loyalty. Like, actually find different ways to keep them connected, because if they do go, there are so many. I don't lose sleep over the existential threat, because we've seen many times that every time a platform, wherever it goes and its kind of maturity, another platform will pop up, and this is mm-hmm. the exciting part of marketing. And it's the balance of all of them. You know, you want to have a diversified portfolio. But I also think to myself, for too long, marketers invested too much in the acquisition and just did not care enough about the retention, or candidly about the word of mouth that comes from really beautiful retention. They would find a way to keep them in the ecosystem in kind of a way that served the business but didn't serve the customer ongoing. So I think that sort of existential threat of that upfront acquisition and just kind of knowing that it's noisier and harder than ever to get them in makes us rethink and candidly have more leverage at the table when I tell them that we're not investing enough long term.
It actually makes you be more creative in some ways. I mean, I feel bad. I'll do one more plug and then no more GE plugs the rest of the time I say anything. But 2 weeks ago, we were the only sponsor of the New York Times Magazine. And it was a special audio zine. So you listened to it and looked at these beautiful pictures.
Is that the volcano?
Yes. I did that. Wasn't it amazing? I love that. Sam Olston and Alexa Casanos are
great
in the audience.
Did
and
that.
They did this brilliant
I
job.
I loved it.
But so it, in a way, Rich, I think, I don't know, this is why I got into marketing. It just sort of forces you to serpentine a little and say, okay, well, everybody's over here. That's not working so well. So what's the alternative?
Rich, I think these guys have said it, but you have to be relevant for the consumer. And part of being relevant is being in the right place at the right time. And it's not ever, to me, about an ad. It's a lot about where is our content being served up, that people want to see it and therefore want to see more. So we spend a lot of time figuring out what's going to go on Instagram versus what's going to go on Facebook versus what we're going to put on Twitter versus what you'll see in a 30-second ad versus what you'll see on a video on YouTube. We spend a lot of time thinking about that because...
And they're all different.
They're all different, but to the point that was made earlier, if there are any creatives in the room, you have to have a very powerful idea that can work across platforms. I think the platforms have allowed a lot of us to get lazy and just say, so this platform is for this, so this is what people are going to do, so let me just throw something on there. You have to still be engaging or people are going to turn away from you. Whether they are allowed to turn away from you or not, you don't know what's registering. They may not click and say 5 seconds in that they're going to skip, but they may be paying zero attention to you. Or they may have every chance to skip, and they're watching and watching and watching and watching. Again, I think someone mentioned...
That's why we called this event attention, right?
Yeah.
We need to get people's attention, not just get a view or a click or Nielsen tell
you
you
need to
be watched.
Absolutely. Yeah. And I think the basic idea of what you do is so very important.
I would just add to that I do think sometimes as a marketer, when you're trying to grow and scale, especially like trying to find that next channel can feel like pulling teeth when it is much more about the platform and the story that can work across everything. And we found, especially by really listening, sometimes you discover opportunities that you didn't even know were there that are more of a pull than a push, which is always the best for a marketer. And so we discovered in our first few years that customers were using our product in ways that we never expected. For example, they were using them for DIY Halloween costumes, which was not something we ever anticipated when we launched our clothing line.
Because they were cheaper and easier to customize because they were solid color?
Yeah, and they're actually quite hard to find, surprisingly, in sort of the full range of colors that could make any costume that you might want to dream up for a kid. And when we heard that, it was something that sort of had taken on a life of its own, but it became our most powerful marketing platform, and it's our biggest month of the year, and we never could have anticipated that. But that was something to play into versus trying to find some way to sort of get the word out.
So let's play a little word association game. I'm going to say a word. You give me your reaction to it. Programmatic advertising. Who wants to start?
I'll start. I'll just say it. Fraud, undesirable inventory, lack of brand control.
Yeah.
Anyone else have a different word?
I feel like she really covered it.
I'm like, that's what keeps me up at night, by the way. That's one of the
is the shift to program or the inertia towards.
Yes.
So how do you resist it? I mean, is it hard not to get sucked into the world of programmatic?
You work with premium publishers, so you actually can mitigate those issues. Because otherwise, I mean, you think about, you know, I think of brands as people. I know that sounds odd, so just go with me on this journey. You would protect, like, the reputation of a family member. I mean, if somebody said something negative, you'd protect them. You should do the same with your brand. And to throw your brand into uncharted territory, into who knows what site, and what the correlations could be made or what have you, that can honestly do damage that you can't ever change. So, yes.
Yeah, I get really fired up about this. I'm like over here like, hmm.
I see you talk about it, so it was sort of a setup.
Yeah. No, I think what you're getting at just sticks with me, which is like, programmatic, I get it. I get the ecosystem. The challenge is that most companies haven't matured to or haven't put the time into thinking about the operations around their brand. So then they don't have brand rules, brand guidelines. Many people can't serve as the protector of the brand. There's only one person that knows it, and they're in a different office, and they don't even know that you're running this test. And so then it like goes down a rabbit hole, and then we decide the whole thing doesn't work. And I guess my kind of point is that you do have to protect it. They're quality above all else, no matter what channel you're on. And things need to be tested. And then to do all of that, you need to have an ecosystem that you've already built and invested in. That story needs to be well documented. You need to have tested the different ways it can come to light. You need to know what partners are quality and what aren't and where you should be. And you need to know the maturity of your different markets. And all of that needs to live somewhere that everyone on the team can access when they're piloting with some programmatic vendor that, you know, caught them on the right day because their line was soft. And like, I think those are the things that I get so frustrated about, because you hear about this big kind of inertia to this channel and everyone gets really worked up about it, but no one knows you got to take a step back. And how would we even be successful if this were to become a meaningful part of how we grew this business?
It makes the big platform stronger, though, right? I mean, isn't that just, I mean, I know it's the end result of this is like they just get bigger and stronger.
It can, certainly. And that's, I mean, I think the thing, right? There's been other platforms that where you've done it and all of a sudden, you know, like, remember, I mean, I hate to bring it up, but like affiliate marketing, right? Like, anytime you kind of access a certain channel and you lose too much control, you're giving that control to someone else. The reality comes down, there has to be governance. There has to be a way to govern that channel, and it can't just be one person's job. The system itself has to be set up to do it.
Now, TV is being watched far less. It's still a huge number. There's no doubt about it, and certainly in other countries. But if we focus on the U.S., TV viewership is down pretty substantially, especially live viewership. It's what's really working is what Pam said. It's live games, live news.
Live news and sports.
Events. Yes. It's events.
Yet, TV advertising, still pretty healthy. I mean, you wouldn't know that ratings were down nearly as much as they are looking at the fact that TV ad spend is still roughly $70 billion. Does that disconnect persist? Is there a breaking point where the gap becomes too wide and dollars shift faster to digital? Or is what's holding back digital from being a much bigger part of your spend for those of you that spend on TV?
Reach. It's reach.
Not attribution, reach.
No, it's reach. I mean, there TV, like it or not, a lot of times, it's reach. If you can get the frequency out there and get the reach, that's why, and the power. I mean, you get optimally, depending on where it's being run, but you can have, if you can afford a 30-second, you get the reach, you can tell the story. It does, I don't think it's right for every brand. I think it really, you have to be very mindful about when you use television in your media mix, but I think there's no platform right now where you can get that level of reach.
I would add reach and impact. So we still do a small percentage, and every year it gets smaller on television. Mm-hmm. And obviously the shift is clearly to digital and some experiential. But there are moments during the Oscars. We debuted our Millie spot during the Oscars. That was the best place for it. Yeah. Biggest reach, biggest impact, great context because we bought time, against IBM's Hidden Figures. So, I mean, it hit every level. We've been in live sports. I think we stopped going to the upfront, six, 7 years ago. You know, this idea of betting your company's money on what might or might not be a hit just seemed ludicrous.
It's a lot of pressure. It's a lot of pressure. Going to the Derby.
Yeah.
But yet there's still a ton of money spent that way.
There is. And I think it depends on the brand. I mean, I think for perhaps, and I don't work at one of them, a classic CPG, that might be the right place to go. It isn't for us.
But is that the opportunity for you, Christina, to take advantage of, like, a lot of those classic brands are still doing the same thing year in and year out?
I think it is. I mean, we're doing, obviously, this is outside of my budget grade here, this conversation on TV. but we are starting to think about it. There is just, I think, quite a bit of opportunity at our stage to accomplish significant reach through social media platforms and otherwise before having to get to that point. But it is also, at the same time, very much about how to tell your story. And if you can tell your story in whatever way you think is the most effective way to get it across and you have the ability to connect with the right people, I think everything is fair game. And I also think that it can be interesting when people retreat from a certain channel. I think it opens up an opportunity as well. Mm-hmm. It's an example of that for us, and not just for us, for lots of people, is direct mail. Even though I think everyone's inundated by it, it's super annoying. I think for a long time, everyone said, that's ridiculous. That's so traditional and old. And then it was like direct mail's back.
What about radio?
You could break through again.
Radio's not dead.
Radio's worked excellently for us, and direct mail's also worked excellently for us.
Newsletters. Yeah. Newsletters are back.
What's your favorite? Come on the spot.
Who's out there?
On the spot. We'll be graded on this.
That's a good one.
So I open up Axios every morning.
Okay.
Second thing I open up every day.
I like Axios a lot.
There's an NBA newsletter. Yeah, there we go.
Sign-ups are occurring at the front desk as well.
NBA.com.
Can I say one more thing on TV before we leave the TV thing?
Thank you, because I want to go back there too.
I want you to go to TV. The last thing I'm going to say on TV is just also, once you do the TV spot, I think one of the most amazing things beyond the reach is the secondary conversation. I mean, how else do you think the NBA, see, I'm getting it in there, clips, SNL clips all get shared? It's through social media, it's through or Reddit boards after Game of Thrones. Like, there's the whole piece on TV and then the pre, post, or during experience. So that, to me, is very interesting, too. Over to you.
What I was going to say is, Rich, you said those brands aren't walking away. I think if you get in under those numbers, you'll see that a lot of them are. Their numbers are just so big to begin with. Mm-hmm. When I started at the NBA 4 years ago, so we want people to watch television. Let me start there. Because the live game, and that's where that's going to be the best viewing experience.
Adam Silver's very happy right now.
He's very happy. But when I started at the NBA, we were our marketing dollars to get you to watch TV, we were spending 70% of our money on TV to get you to watch TV. We've shifted that. We spend now about 30% of our money on TV, and the rest is in digital.
That's in 4 years.
That's in 4 years. And wow. So I think, and my budgets aren't as big as Linda's, and they are not as big as some of these other companies you're
talking
about.
It's a budget off.
But it's a budget
it's
off.
It's a budget off.
But I think some of those brands that you're talking about are shifting their dollars. It's just that they have so much money in television. It takes a while, and they're afraid to do a 15, 20% shift a year. They're shifting 5% a year.
Yeah, I mean,
and then
it doesn't
look like
it. If I said
like
shift 40% over 3 years to most CMOs, I think they would like be that face, that expression
that
is what
face.
I would get.
Well, because they're not like, under 35.
Yeah, if Mark Pritchard like were up here and you said shift 40% of your budget. It's
over a four-year time frame.
I think if it's public or private, I think that's the difference. Public companies, there's a lot because of the sheer size, if you will, and the Wall Street pressure on shifting too many things too quickly. If you're a private company, you absolutely can make
it's where your consumers are.
Yeah.
I mean, that's what it should
be based on. We're all living with this thing attached to our face basically all day long, right?
And it's interesting. There's also different multiples of audiences sometimes for public companies. So I'm not saying I put an ad out there to reach our analysts, but, you know, because we're a large company, it's would-be employees, it's Wall Street, it's our partners. So I think that may also differ little bit.
Different constituents.
Yep.
So if we think about that, those digital dollars that are growing, even if TV is still very relevant, we've heard a lot about Facebook tonight. Many of you mentioned Facebook and Instagram, despite all of the noise about how big and bad Facebook and Instagram may be. But I'm just curious, like, what do you see as being more important to your business versus less important? As you look across, whether it's LinkedIn, Pinterest, you know, Snapchat, Facebook, Instagram, what's growing in importance, or where are you putting more of your own effort and think, you know, where do you see better ROI for your brand?
Yeah, I mean, my answer might not be the answer you're looking for, but we've actually pulled significantly back from paid. And I think, you know, a lot of companies, like, again, I've not been through
that. I didn't have a predetermined answer. I was just curious.
We were heavily focused on referral and paid, you know, for the first couple of years of ClassPass. And I think in the last year and a half with the shifts that have happened, particularly on the Facebook platform, mm-hmm. knowing that, you know, we can still invest in that
from
prospect.
From an organic reach standpoint, mm-hmm. meaning the organic reach is just not good enough.
That and the fact that they don't have enough inventory and, you know, prices are getting hacked up and direct response is, like, diminishing returns, so you got to invest up in prospecting, and when you're doing that, you've got to be able to kind of have the attribution to back it up. And we've just pulled back. I think also, you know, certain audiences of ours are not actually on Facebook, and actually very similar to what you mentioned, we're going into different countries where this is not the platform we're going to be using, and that's an exciting challenge for us. Where we see that we're spending a massive amount of our dollars is in the content machine itself, and allowing, you know, those owned platforms to work for us. And I think, you know, we do amplify that content. We're always thinking about how we can get that content in front of more people so they can pass it on our behalf. But we actually spend massive money into beautiful, differentiated, unique, distinct content that when you put it out into the world, will have longer
And where lives. Is that content generally living?
Yeah, so right now, the majority is either in social channels or we're actually doing kind of like distribution partnerships. So either co-branded partnerships, working with different pubs, thinking about unique ways combining with different newsletters that are non-paid partnerships, mm-hmm. but, you know, whether it be different kind of partnerships around a campaign with things like The Skim or other kind of, you know, audience vehicles that have our audience, so that we're in the front of them with a partner, that's where our dollars are actually going. And it's been very successful for us because this native advertising piece and this co-branded content piece is so true to who we are, which is we're just having a conversation. It happens to be here. But it's not necessarily like we are placing it there, you know, with the expectation there will be a direct response conversion behind it.
Pam?
I'm not being PC when I say this. I'm not trying to be anyway. But we really do use all of the platforms, and we use them very differently. I would say that video is still king right now. Mm. So we spend a lot of time making sure our video is very well done, and also as instantaneous as possible, and get it out there as quick as possible for our consumers. So video is any of the platforms where video is appropriate, it's huge for us. But we literally are everywhere.
But so like YouTube, Twitter, those platforms, you need, and Instagram, you need video quick, fast, and digestible.
Yes, yes. And not only, don't just think about the league, because I manage what the league does. Think about the 450 players that every day, I mean, I literally every morning I wake up, the first thing I do is look and see what every player has done the night before.
What a morning!
I mean, it's great though.
I'm gonna
Some of it
doing
might
that.
Be a little scary.
I'm
going
to start doing
great.
That.
It's great because they are each a brand, and they all know what they're doing. Well, mm-hmm. most of them know exactly what they're doing.
About 70% know. Exactly.
And then you have teams doing the same stuff. So it's a combination of what teams are doing, what we're doing at the league, and what our players are doing. So we are literally everywhere.
I read a stat, I think it's worth sharing, the other day, that by the end of 2020, 82% of all content consumed will be video format. I mean, when you think about, yeah. from a, you know, and that's so true, and yet, I don't know about you guys, but it took a long time to get everyone behind the video. Like, you're still trying to convince teams of that, because, and by the time everyone gets to it, now you have to be the best
at it. Well, I think Instagram was just square
yeah.
picture,
yeah.
right?
But you think about the intersection of voice display. Like, the display is where the video is going, and, like, that's the next thing.
Yep.
I'm actually a similar position of you in the sense that I love all social media platforms and all, but you look at some of the bigger ones like Facebook, it is truly pay-to-play. And there is a point, at least for some brands, where if your social dollars, going back to a premise I said earlier, you have a social dollar. That social dollar could go towards, in general, usually search, affiliate, other things. Social is not the highest ROI, so you need to make the case on, is it building your brand? Are you getting to the people you want? And increasingly, frankly, we've been experimenting, whether it's going back to direct mail and had amazing results bouncing people back to the web or to retail stores in China or Latin America. I think the part with social that's most fascinating to me, going back to your point, is actually around YouTube and video, going back to the stats on that. I mean, when the video content year over year is growing over 19%, there's no stopping of that. So it's figuring out how do you play best there, and that's where we're shifting a bit more.
Linda?
So I have a simple answer on this one. So I can remember, and I don't know how many of you do, when most people watch three or four networks. And if people were watching three or four networks today, that's where we would be spending our time and our money. But they're not. So to me, I simplify this. We want to be on the platforms where our audience is and where they're over-indexing. And that varies greatly. You know, Rich and I have talked about this. Sometimes for us it can be LinkedIn because of the number of professionals. But we are completely ubiquitous. We do a ton of work on Instagram and Twitter, maybe a little less on Snap, a ton on Facebook. But it all comes down to attention and where our audience is engaging. I completely agree on the owned effort. And increasingly, we do more and more and push it either through our social channels or you know, some channels we've created, sort of owned and operated channels. But I don't know, if I woke up tomorrow and everybody in the universe was on NBC, you know, you'd have to sort of say, well, wait a minute, what are we doing? Mm-hmm. So I think of it that way.
Christina, where does the startup put their money?
Well, it's clarifying when you don't have a lot of it. And it has to deliver
stretching
now.
Dollars.
And so what I will say is that when a channel works for you, and we certainly learned that focusing on a channel, and our approach has been to do things in-house to really learn and master it before we consider really how to scale it, you know, we didn't feel bad about the fact that we were focusing on Facebook and not Snapchat because it didn't seem as cool, because it was delivering. And so we weren't apologetic about it. We focused on it. We mastered it. We figured out what was working, and we kept figuring that out over time.
Probably more moms on Facebook, too, than Snapchat.
There are. And I think for that reason, it worked for us. Certainly, though, it is the case that you don't want to be too dependent on it, and you want to diversify. And for us, video has also been a focus. And the thing that I would say about that is that you don't have to spend hundreds of thousands of dollars to do video well. So much, especially, I would say, in the early stages when you know your business the best and you are really focused on thinking about the storytelling, you can come up with a great idea and you can have like a group of people on your team sort of come up with something, and then you could go out and spend a couple hundred thousand dollars having an agency develop it. And we've had better results with what we've produced in-house. Mm-hmm. And so I just think focus on the ideas. Focus on what you know about your business and the stories you want to tell, and try some things.
We have a ton of entrepreneurs in the audience, building businesses, people investing in businesses, thinking about businesses. What technologies are you most excited about? What's on the bleeding edge technology-wise that you're looking at as a marketing channel?
It's an interesting sort of combination of these traditional channels that have perhaps become more ignored, whether it be direct mail and radio, as well as newer channels like podcasts that we're certainly testing into. You kind of have to consider the full range, and it is just so much more about where do you think you can effectively tell your story, what format.
I'm a huge bull on podcasting.
What's that?
I'm a huge bull on podcasting.
Yeah, absolutely. But you have to ask yourself these important questions. Do you really think you can tell your story in the right way, and whatever that format is, and are the people there and engaged? And sort of ready to receive.
I just love the old school aspect of like radio. When you think back to like, you know, the house reads on radio.
Yeah.
That's to what podcast feels like, going back to the old days of radio.
It's storytelling.
Yeah, exactly.
It's going
back.
You love. It's going back to. It's interesting on how many things right now are reverting back. It's simple storytelling, and for a moment you're escaping and engaging in that world with a great story. It's actually very simple, but very powerful.
I would say it's not necessarily one of the traditional platforms, but we are very much interested at the NBA in AR and VR. Mm. One of the reasons, think about this, just the U.S., forget the rest of the world for now, but of all the fans we have in the U.S., only 1% have actually ever gone to a game and sat in an arena.
Wow.
And has anybody ever been to an arena? Have any of you sat courtside? You're lying if you say yeah. You're lying.
Never?
Maybe you're not. But it's really expensive to sit courtside. But with VR technology, you can make every fan in that arena feel like they're sitting courtside. So that's what's of interest to us, is how do you really make that fan have that kind of experience? And so we're very much not only experimenting, but we've done our first game in VR. We did the finals last year, the Golden State. We did a documentary. So you could go kind of behind the scenes with the players, and see what they were doing and be so up close and personal with them. So that's very exciting to us right now. I know some of you can afford to sit courtside. I can't.
But I think the great point on that is what that's avoiding. Like, I love all the technologies. Going to South By to me is like amazing. But you get into this shiny object syndrome, which you're like, ooh, this is magical. But again, this is where you have to go back. How am I helping my consumer? You're helping your consumer with that. Like, to me, one of the best uses of AR right now, I just bought a home. Trying to figure out scale, unless you're like an engineer by trade, not so easy. You go to IKEA with their app with AR, that is a phenomenal application of technology. And for me, like further out, not for KEDS, but my next thing probably, I think the intersection of voice and display. If anyone has kids here, and you watch a child with a smart home device and how they are searching with their voice at this point and how they expect it to come back. And they're like, no, not that image, the next one. It's a whole new world. You're watching the next round of marketers and consumers growing up. And I think that's something that's really exciting.
My daughter, the youngest, 8, she goes up to the Alexa on
that's correct.
This weekend. And she goes, tell me a joke that involves the sea. And it actually returns a joke about, it was funny that like it actually did know how to process that skill.
We'll talk about the trivia question. Every day my child makes it a trivia thing, and I either have an awesome start to the day or I'm crushed by not knowing like Greek mythology.
How do brands play in this world of voice? Where do brands fit? I mean, I see lots of trivia. I see lots of like turn lights on, but like how do brands live in a voice world?
Eventually voice search. I mean, I think about it, like what are the best for, like if I was at KEDS, what are the best white sneakers? It's like a Google PLA. You could have one of your, eventually it's going to mature and you can be in there in a relevant way.
I think utility too. When I think about Alexa and voice activated, I think it's sort of shifting your mindset to say, what utility could I as a brand stand for? I mean, to me, Alexa, Google Home, voice generated is just, it's going to change everything.
It already has helped us. I mean, we have a deal with Alexa. You can go to Alexa and you can find out what games are the Celtics playing the first 2 weeks of the season.
Yeah, that's correct.
And where.
Yeah. I really do.
Y'all go do that with your favorite team.
I do think
that was very on brand, by the way. Very on brand.
I'll send you a video of my son doing that every morning. And I'm like,
I'm sorry,
Joanna,
what were you going to say?
No, I was just going to say, I do think it's the utility of it. Like, you wouldn't think that ClassPass as a brand would have much to do with Alexa, but we're already thinking about what features we're going to build in so that you can, in the morning when it reads you back your school, it tells you what class you're going to. And like, I think we're going to fix and change how we do reservations and booking to make that work, because the future is us waking up and having a device tell us our day and suggest alternatives to that day and mention that you have 4 to 5 open and, hey, that favorite yoga class of yours top by the street happens to have an opening. Would you like us to book that for you? That's the future of it. And I think it gets really exciting and also somewhat terrifying. But if you're not thinking about that and how it's going to be controlling what a consumer even does with their free time, because we've talked a lot about it, but I'll just kind of, I believe this deeply. We're all after time. We all just want more minutes of their mind share. And we're lucky if we get 10 seconds or I get 60 minutes, you get multiple
attention hours.
Yeah.
Attention.
And I think, attention.
Attention.
And that is going, time will be controlled by devices.
And think of a time when Alexa or whichever device you love gets to know you so well that it's not waiting for the question, but it knows your brand preferences. It's predictive. It knows what kind of workouts you like. And that's really close.
I look forward to the day that I come home late and I order pizza and it knows that I've had a couple glasses of wine and it just cancels that morning class for me. it just knows I'm not making it to that class. And I don't get the
There's
late
a strong
cancel
wine
thing.
Element to this panel.
I know it's coming. I'm excited.
Or it tells you it went great the next morning even though you didn't go.
What company do you look up to most from a marketing standpoint? When you go, their marketing crushes it. What jumps into your head first? Just rapid fire.
Nike.
Oh, come on.
Pressure.
Right.
Yeah.
Patagonia.
Restoration Hardware has caught my attention lately, and they're right around the corner.
I think for us, it's like Lego and Crayola. They were our inspiration.
Yeah. I would have done all of those. But I think for me, I would probably go, I'm a Seattle girl, so I would have said Patagonia, but I would say REI. I think it's anyone that is going to take a stand and convince me to do something better with my time.
I love REI. I like Patagonia too a lot.
All right, so we're going to stop right there just before the Q&A session began, because that actually went on for another 30 minutes or so, and you've got stuff to do. But I will point out that two of the questions were about influencer marketing. The responses to that were so good that we've made a blog post specifically about that. So even though you don't get to hear them right now, you can still read about them. All of the details are in the show notes, but if you go to betaworks-studios.com/stories, you can see what these five great CMOs really think about influencer marketing, and I'm betting it's probably different from what you think. On that same stories page, you'll find all of the other episodes of Builders. So if you enjoyed this one, you should check out some of our other episodes, like episode 8, Future Tech for Brands, which featured leaders from Google, Gray, Giphy, and RGA, speaking about how future technology will affect brands. And you should probably check out the very episode we put out that covered building experiences in the age of Instagram. Of course, if you're bored with all this marketing and brand talk, we have episodes on things like blockchain and why you should probably delete all of your social media. So to round this out, thanks again to Rich Greenfield for hosting this session. It was really great to see so many people engaging with the speakers. Once again, you heard from Joanna Lord, Pam Eel, Emily Culp, Linda Boff, and Christina Carbonell. Huge thanks to them for spending that evening with us. If you'd like to spend some time with us, check out our membership details at betaworks-studios.com. As we grow the Builder community, we'll still be holding many public events, but the best stuff tends to happen during the day at BetaWorks Studios between the members, all sharing ideas and making stuff happen. If you'd like a day pass, just let me know. I can be found on Twitter at Layla Oweda. But also feel free to just click on the description box for other ways to reach me. So for more episodes of Builders, just subscribe on Apple or wherever you choose to listen. Check back with us every Tuesday for new episodes. And if you leave us a review in iTunes, that would help so many more people find all of this great knowledge. Follow along with us on social media. We can be found on Twitter, Instagram, and Facebook at BuildersPod, #BuildersPodcast for all things Builders. If you click on the description box, it's all linked there. We look forward to hearing from you. And until next time, I'm Layla Oweda. Happy building from all of us at the BetaWorks Studios team.